and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 29th of May with me, Ian Welsh. I hope you and yours are well. Coming up this week, we have insight from both Intel and Fairtrade America. Following the recent Innovation Forum Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference, I spoke with Mike McDonnell, Intel's Senior Manager for Supply Chain Sustainability, about how increasing clarity and specificity in terms of what's required in human rights due diligence helps businesses while constantly throwing up new challenges. And I recently interviewed Mary Linnell Simmons from Fairtrade America about some of the trade and human rights implications from the coronavirus pandemic, including child labour and other abuses. No news roundup this time. It'll return next week. This week, I've been attending Innovation Forum's online US-focused Future of Food event. We've had some fascinating conversations, and I will be reporting from the event and interviewing participants over the coming weeks, so do listen out for those. Next week, on 2nd and 3rd of June, is our Europe-focused Future of Food event. Among those sharing insight will be experts from Unilever, Nestle, Danone, Barry Callebaut, Innocent Drinks, and Mars Wrigley. And there's still time to sign up. I do hope you can join us. Our rescheduled Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference, originally to be held in London in March, will now be online on the 23rd and 24th of June. Among the confirmed speakers are business experts from L'Oreal, Mondelez International, AB InBev, Samsung, Fairtrade and Freshfields. And we're really excited about our recently launched online Sustainable Landscapes Week from 2nd to 6th November. This will include a series of focused interactive workshops around an extended conference this year over 3 days. Already signed up to take part are senior representatives from Sime Darby, April, Tate & Lyle, WWF, Burger King and the Consumer Goods Forum, and passes are now available. A few days ago, I spoke with Fairtrade America's Director of Marketing, Mary Linnell Simmons, about some of the new human rights challenges being thrown up by the COVID-19 pandemic. We also talked about how consumer brand relationships are changing, particularly around concerns over social issues. We're going to be reflecting on some of the issues that came up at our recent Ethical Trade and Human Rights event, which was supported by Fairtrade America. Mary, what are the human rights impacts of the pandemic that you are seeing for your stakeholders right now?
So Fairtrade America works with about 2 million farmers and workers across the world. And we work mainly in commodities like cocoa, coffee, and bananas. So we're definitely seeing some issues starting to emerge with the producers that we work with and are continuing to monitor those. For cocoa, for example, about 2/3 of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa. And the West African main harvest season happened just prior to the main outbreak that's been happening around the world. However, we are seeing issues arising in the mid-season harvest. In particular, we're monitoring for increased rates of child labor. So anybody who works in cocoa knows, even people who don't work in cocoa know that the industry really suffers from child labor and human rights issues. And so that we're seeing that with more schools closed, less places for children to go, and also more issues with the mid-harvest season, more need for support, there is definitely an increase of the likelihood of child labor. There's also the issue that there's less monitoring on the ground. So some of the initial sources of monitoring are not there and not in place. Fairtrade has a really tough anti-child labor policy in our standards, and we're committed to that. We're also committed to training up the cooperative groups that we work with and their wider communities to support tackling child labor through our youth-inclusive, community-based monitoring and remediation system. But this system really gets to the root of child labor because it empowers local youth in the community to identify it and work with community leaders on solutions to prevent future occurrences. So it's really not about, you know, a certification system swooping in with a bunch of people with clipboards and then saying what the issues are. It's really about the community working together to both identify and remediate the issues. We've already seen a lot of successes with this program on sugarcane farms in Belize. In terms of other industries that we work with that are suffering or we anticipate some kind of COVID-related impact, we're seeing an increased need in coffee, especially in South America. So the South American harvest season has begun, and with so much coffee being grown in places like Colombia, Brazil, Peru, coronavirus is definitely having a really big impact on this. We've seen that this shows where historical injustices are really coming to the fore now with this current crisis. So for example, the price of coffee has been very low for the past few years. Last year, the average price of coffee was $1.02 a pound. For the record, Fair Trade calculates the sustainable floor price of coffee production at $1.40 a pound. So that's a 40% difference. The fact that businesses were not paying enough for coffee meant that many coffee producers were either already suffering, already running a really lean operation that is not fit for a crisis in the future, or to be honest, had left coffee production or minimized their production because of the issues of just not getting enough money to send their kids to school, to put food on the table. In a very converse twist, coffee prices right now are actually really high because there is this anticipated lack of supply that's coming down the line and a couple of other issues within that. So we're seeing that farmers are rushing to get the coffee harvested, but then also having to care for workers who will come to pick the coffee. On many of the smallholder farms that we work with, the farmers themselves run a very lean operation up until harvest season and then hire seasonal workers to come in and help with the very manual job of picking coffee cherries off of the bushes at the precise time that they're ripe, which if anybody works in coffee, they know that the cherries ripen at different times on the exact same bush. So you really need to have somebody picking as the berries themselves ripen. The issue is that many of the workers who would be coming either are concerned for their own safety, they're taking care of relatives, they're maybe not able to travel as they would with reduced transportation options. So there's a concern that there will be less people to pick the coffee cherries off of the bushes. There's also a concern about regulations of how to keep people safe, and so providing extra layers of support and if the farms are going to be able to do that. And then there is a concern of the trucks to take the coffee to the ports. Many people who would drive the trucks are not operating on the same schedule because they're concerned about their own health. And then there's a concern that the ports might close due to coronavirus. So we are expecting issues with the harvest and coffee. We're also expecting prices to increase and that to affect consumers in the United States, for example. So we're expecting an increase in coffee prices to be reflected on the shelves. Unfortunately, that increase in price will not necessarily all be going to farmers. It will just be going to some of the issues within the system. But we do hope that some of that is reflected in the extra risk farmers are taking.
Can we go back to child labor issues? I know this is something that's very important for fair trade. In the cocoa sector, how do you differentiate between children perhaps helping out occasionally on family farms in a way that has been happening for generations and happens throughout the world versus actual child labor full-time that they're lacking, not going to school and being forced to work full-time inappropriately? How do you differentiate between these?
So fair trade follows the International Labor Organization's ILO's standards for child labor, and they have some very clear indications of what means child labor and what doesn't mean child labor. So for example, children should be able to go to school and that any work on family farms should not impact them going to school up to a certain age. And a lot of times that age is defined in the country. So 16, for example, might be in a specific country. So children should have the ability to go to school and not be forced to work on their own family's farm. But if they come home from school and then need to help out with some of the farm chores, that's not considered child labor necessarily. There are all these other criteria, though, that will or will not put a child into the child labor bracket. So for instance, carrying something that's over a certain weight would be considered child labor because it would be considered harming the child's health if something is, say, 100 pounds and they're trying to carry it up a hill. But carrying something that isn't that weight is not considered child labor. So where that line of yes, child labor, no child labor is both clear and fuzzy at the same time, and why it's one of the most difficult things to address, especially when it is children helping out their family on their own family farms, where that begins and ends. I think we can all agree that there is a very clear line when children are being forced to work on not their family's farm, maybe their paperworks and whatnot have been taken away so that they cannot return to where they were previously. They're not getting paid. They're being abused. I think we can all agree that that is an egregious form of child labor and slavery, which is sometimes wrapped up into the same bundle as children helping on their family's farms.
Let's think about consumers and consumer brands then that I know you work with. How do you think that relationships between consumers and brands is changing? And what's been the impact of the pandemic?
So we are seeing that shoppers are definitely expecting change. I think that anybody who is going through this currently, watching the news, seeing the updates, we are not expecting business as usual to continue after we get through the worst of this crisis. People are expecting change. I think that this has also shed a light on some of the really gross inequalities in our system writ large, both within countries like the United States and within global supply chains, and shown how those with less means and less voice are really hit the hardest. So this was something that came up at the Ethical Trade and Human Rights Forum discussions the other week, was the idea of how Maslow's hierarchy of needs and how this crisis is really fitting into that. So we can all agree that at first, you know, in the kind of February, March time of this crisis, people really contracted into those lowest rungs of the pyramid. They were really concerned about their personal well-being, having enough food on the table, their own health and safety. You know, that's where the grocery runs came in. People were hunkering down and really looking after their own. And now that, you know, we've settled into this situation a little bit more, we're starting to look up the pyramid a bit more and looking at how we can help others now that are some of the basic needs have been met for some. So we've seen brands stepping up with this, for example. So many people have heard lots of stories about how brands are making donations to healthcare workers, to essential workers. Some of the brands that we work with, such as Brooklyn Coffee Roasters or Higher Ground Coffee, have been donating to their local hospitals so that they can keep doctors and nurses caffeinated. We've also seen some brands that we work with, like Nature's Path Granola and Endangered Species Chocolate, donating both to food banks and to first responders as well. And I think part of this response is because brands are run by people who actually care about other people in their community, which is a wonderful thing. But I think part of it as well is that shoppers are expecting them to step up. They're looking at brands who espouse certain values to now more than ever, you know, really show those values, really live by those values. And it just doesn't cut it if you don't step up at this time.
So what does this mean then for certification bodies?
Supply chains are complicated here. And if you ask many companies where their cocoa comes from or where their sugar comes from or where their coffee beans come from, many of them might have no idea. You know, they buy from traders, they buy from importers, and they don't know exactly where they're coming from. We spoke earlier in this conversation about anticipating an increased risk of child labor in cocoa supply chains in West Africa, for example. Companies really need to be actively working to combat such issues and taking them on as their problems and not ignoring them and hoping that it doesn't affect their supply chain. Because at the end of the day, if you're not actually looking into your supply chain, you can no longer claim that you just didn't know and you're sorry. I think it's very, very important that brands are taking care of those people in their supply chains, because no one's going to care if you donated to first responders. If you have children working in the fields or if you have children working in the factories, no one is going to care if you donated to first responders. I think that brands really need to step it up, and that's where certification can play a role. Fair Trade is a certification that is working with brands, is working with farmers to mitigate these risks in their supply chains. We're also working to not just check for problems, but actually improve the lives of farmers so that they can weather such storms into the future. And that's very important for brands, that they have strong supply chains now more than ever. They need to know that they can rely on where their goods are going to come from for their products.
How much does your work tell you in terms of shifting consumer demands around looking for assurance on social issues and environmental issues? Are you seeing any trends there?
In the United States, the trend has definitely been on environmental issues so far. Consumers tend to care a little bit more about things such as organic, non-GMO, historically. In Europe, the trend has been for a while now, not just on environmental issues, but also on social issues like fair trade, like B Corp would be considered a social issue. We're definitely seeing the U.S. track a little bit behind European countries on those trends, but you know, we are still tracking in the same trajectory, and we expect fair trade to become more and more an important issue in this regard. Environmental issues have a very clear what's in it for me, for the shoppers. You know, I'm choosing to buy organic food so that my kids don't have pesticides, for example. But we're seeing that, especially within this crisis, people are realizing how connected we are, both in our smaller communities as well as a global community. The choices that shoppers are making today will affect what is on the shelves in the future. So, for example, the average age of a cocoa farmer in West Africa is 50 years old, which sounds kind of old until you realize that the average life expectancy is 60 years old. And so the reason why young people are not going into farming partly is because if they're going to be earning less than $2 a day and they're seeing their parents struggle, why would they choose that for themselves if they have more options available through better education? So we're not going to have chocolate in the future if we don't step it up as shoppers and pay a little bit more and make that trade more equitable.
How do you think certifying organizations such as Fair Trade can work best with businesses so that the labeling is relevant and also helping brands to communicate effectively on ethics?
So Fair Trade has been working in this sphere for about 30 years now across the world. And we see ourselves as really a partner with brands on some of their sustainability goals. And I think that that's very, very important for brands to consider what their goals are, what they're looking to address both now and into the future. And working with an organization such as a certifying organization that can be an actual partner with them and get to the root of some of those things. Brands need to consider what is the most information that they find relevant in their supply chain. What are the issues that they find most relevant? Is it about identifying alternative and ethical sources of supply that they can have access to in the future? Is it about mitigating child labor? Is it about, for example, we worked with some brands on addressing climate change by doing some adaptive techniques in terms of planting different strains of coffee to see how that would work in their supply chains and for the farmers. We need to make sure that it is equitable across the supply chain so that the people who are growing the food are getting just as much benefit as the brands producing and manufacturing and selling the food. Fairtrade also provides, like many third-party certifiers, some element of storytelling. So brands want to be able to tell the story of the good that they're doing through this additional investment in their supply chain. And so Fairtrade is able to help connect shoppers to those stories so that they can have a better idea of the real people behind where their food is coming from.
It does feel that people are going to want that ever more right now and into the future. And the kind of partnership side of things is going to be something that's going to develop further and further as consumers demand to know the story behind their food and the brands themselves are happy to develop that story for them. Is that the kind of future you see?
That's definitely the future we see. And we also see that there is an uptick in concern about some of the human rights issues within the food supply chain. So we talked a little bit about that at the forum the other week. We're seeing that as more and more people are becoming aware of these challenges and these issues, you know, it just takes one investigative report to really throw out a lot of years of hard work and brand building for companies. And so one of the things that we do is by that constant monitoring, by being on the ground, by providing the intel, it's really about shoring up those supply chains so that brands do not necessarily have to go into a negative cycle with them.
It's certainly true that one bad story can put a lot of hard work to one side very rapidly. Thanks very much indeed, Mary Linnell Simmons from Fair Trade America.
Thank you, Ian.
Earlier in May, I had a chance to catch up with Mike McDonnell, Senior Manager for Supply Chain Sustainability at Intel. We talked about some of the ongoing compliance challenges for a business with 10,000 suppliers, how more specific rules and guidance is a real help, and why supplier mapping is an essential initial step. Thinking back to our session recently and also the conference, how are you finding the requirements for your business are changing in terms of compliance on human rights?
I think, yeah, they're increasing. Maybe across the board almost, maybe not equally from different stakeholders, but increasing, and I think becoming a bit more clear. Instead of just being broad, there's more specificity around certain issues that we need to be watching after. And that's coming from either regulations, that's probably the most recent, that's really kind of picked up the most. Ratings and socially responsible investors are asking questions. Usually our consumers are mostly businesses, so our big customers are asking us questions with even more clarity. Those three areas are really all increasing for us, and they're being very specific on issues. Is it child labor, forced labor, something specific on environment or chemicals?
And your customers being specific then, is that helpful for you?
It is. then we can align that with our objectives and know where maybe if we have something that we're not covering that's important to a critical customer, then we can work that into our plans.
I know your supply chain is impressively large. I think it's 10,000 suppliers you said you had in your supply chain. What are the benefits you find of supplier mapping to identify the key areas of risk in your supply chain?
That's right. We've got at least that many, and it probably gets bigger on a daily basis. We tend to focus broadly to cover our critical direct suppliers, and then we selectively map down into the tier two and tier three space. Really trying to do that more on a short-term basis, and where we see a specific risk, be it based on the supplier's maturity, our direct supplier's maturity, the location, the commodity, and work with them to try and really bring them up to a point where they become accountable for managing their supply chain. Because with such a big supply base that we have, those 10,000 suppliers, it's impractical, obviously, with those kind of numbers to do that. And so we're having to find the focus areas in what I call the higher risk tier two and tier three spaces and work with those direct suppliers initially auditing some of their tier twos and tier threes, but then over time, moving them to a point where then they can self-manage and self-monitor.
You made an interesting point when we were talking earlier about how you insert in your contracts with your tier one suppliers, they must cascade your requirements, your code of conduct and everything else down there to their suppliers and so on. Do you find this is useful then, giving it almost a kind of a contractual right to access the depth of your supply chain?
It is. I mean, honestly, we would, of course, hope to not have to call upon that condition in our contracts or our purchase orders. But as a backstop, and certainly, you know, as we're talking oftentimes, some difficult situations, that allows us to get in there a little bit more easily. I think that's just a basic foundational element. And you really hope to not have to use it if you're building good relations with your suppliers.
I guess for those suppliers, I mean, I guess it's identifying the areas of risk. It's all about materiality, I suppose. Supplier mapping, I imagine, is how you go about identifying the areas of risk in your supply chain.
It's a constant circular or iterative activity of thinking about what your supply chain, what it looks like, really the structure of it, where are your big suppliers, what are they producing, working to understand their business model. That brings a lot of potential risk from a staffing standpoint. Do they subcontract? Do they provide living accommodations? Where are they located? And then obviously all the other kind of factors in that space come in, rule of law factors in a lot from a location standpoint and the historic issues that you found in a particular area. Others out there in the world find issues or find locations where certain issues occur that we don't realize immediately. And so we rely on that and constantly scanning and learning from others about what they're seeing so that we avoid those blind spots and then can adjust in our future plans. Where are we going to assess? Where are we going to audit next?
What tools do you find useful when you're doing all this? Are there any specific tools you use? And what characterizes a good tool in this regard?
It doesn't have to actually be too fancy. We use a lot of very basic things in terms of surveying our suppliers to get some initial information when we're bringing a new supplier on. But then we are also part of an industry association, the RBA, Responsible Business Alliance, that offers online surveys that get into a greater depth of understanding of different labor elements, the health and safety, the environmental ethics and management systems. So using those and mining those for information, I'll tell you what we look at a lot, Ian, is the inherent risk. Really trying to understand what could potentially go on or go wrong. It's really kind of difficult to always understand the strength of a control, but you can at least understand the inherent risk that a particular supplier has. And then from there, deciding when and how to engage. We'll maybe put a supplier further down in our to-do list if it seems like their controls are strong, but we're still eventually going to want to go talk to somebody like that if they have a certain level of inherent risk. And so being able to have a tool that allows you to understand where do they staff from? What does their labor force look like? What are living conditions like? What kind of chemicals do they have? What type of safety risks do they have? And then come back to them and verify controls and monitoring as your part of due diligence, second stage, if you will.
And all part of this is using audit still. I mean, auditing is much maligned in many cases, but it remains an essential tool in the box. So where are things in terms of auditing for you? Where's the best practice now for your sector, perhaps, in terms of auditing and use of audits?
Yeah, I'll call on the RBA here a little bit. We use the validated audit program process there that creates an excellent framework. It's got multiple checkpoints around all of the elements of the RBA code. It relies on a combination of evidence, not just walking through a factory and talking to management, but also real detailed worker interview elements that are important, things that must be checked for an auditor to come back and report on that audit. So we think that's still very critical. That said, I'm part of the working group within the RBA on the audit program. We are continuously working to improve that. Every month we meet and we're talking about how to continue to make that stronger and better, be it how do we better engage with the audit firms, understanding what the auditors are feeding back to us, what are things we may have missed in our audit approach that were caught by somebody else, if you will. How do we work that into our processes? So any of these tools, I think you can definitely, you know, let them degrade. And if you do, then yeah, it's not going to be valuable. But the concept of going and verifying in some way, we put this word audit on it, it's still a function that's going to exist. Call it an assessment, call it an audit, call it a visit. It's got certain elements and you have to be thinking about those underlying elements and the effort and the details to which you dig and poke at those risks.
And have things moved forward in terms of sharing of data? Where are we in that?
I think across the industry, there's a fairly good amount of sharing. I think we probably collectively could do better there as well, though. There's some audits that are just conducted by individual companies. We will do that sometimes ourselves, right, on very small suppliers or a supplier who's just on site, maybe a local supplier. But putting them through a full third-party audit is a little difficult for them. Some of that gets broken down a little bit, but we're constantly challenging each other to say, okay, what are we missing? What would make company X want to use the RBA audit program more frequently so that then audits can be shared? It is difficult sometimes. Other challenges remain around the size of audities and being able to audit an entire campus sometimes under the umbrella of one audit can be a challenge. And so that does limit some of the shareability in some parts, as well as kind of intellectual property concerns and some of that. So those are still issues to kind of be tackled.
The debate around human rights in business is clearly moving towards a more due diligence approach rather than a disclosure approach. To what extent do you welcome this, Mike? Do you have any case studies you can share with us of good due diligence in practice?
I think it's important that I don't just tell you and the world that, hey, we did a bunch of audits or we did a bunch of surveys and we didn't find anything. I think it's important, as we heard a bit through the conference, especially near the end, was that you have to be able, as the UN tells us, to know and show. And unless you have an incredibly simplistic supply chain, which I joke sometimes is just going out in your back garden and picking grass, if your supply chain is anything more complicated than that, you likely have some problems. And if you are not identifying them and being able to at least talk about identification and correction, it's hard for me to believe that you've got a good program in place. Me as a customer is looking for that understanding. So I don't just look at this as a supplier, but I'm also looking at it as a customer. And I look to my supply base to be able to demonstrate that. So I welcome that. I think all of us have to be in that space to be able to stand up and say in some way, figure it out. Maybe there's some boundary conditions here we have around disclosure and risks of some of that. But there are definite ways. It's been done by many, many good firms on talking about the good work they're doing while telling people as well what they're still working on, where are they looking next, and so forth, to help guide others as well. We find that incredibly helpful, is reading other people's corporate responsibility reports, their modern slavery disclosures, things like that, to constantly learn from each other.
I guess that leads you to what is the approach you should be taking, learning from others through the associations you're a part of, learning from your suppliers. I guess that's the way to really know and demonstrate that you're doing the right thing.
It's very satisfying, quite honestly, right? The fact that we can collaborate on this, which really should be a non-competitive element and rather the friendly race to the top activity. And that's what's very actually enriching to me about the job, is that ability to be able to reach out to so many different other practitioners in this space through organizations such as yourselves who help facilitate that. And you didn't even pay me to say that. So it's really helpful and it's really satisfying. I think it's what's propelling us in the last couple of years, is that ability to do things like we just did over the last couple of days and get together and share best practices and challenge each other and build those abilities to kind of collaborate.
Just in closing, what do you think the conversation is going to be in a year's time? And I hope it's not just going to be all about dealing with the pandemic right now. So what are you hoping to hear in a year's time?
I hope that we've experimented a bit more with scaling. How do we reach a broader set of suppliers? After doing this a number of years ourselves, we're challenging ourselves to go broader. So what are the things we've tried? Where have we failed? Where have we succeeded on scaling out? And then on the back of the virus and that is, are there better ways to use technology in this space? And I think we'll have to all pilot and practice and try some things there. And so hopefully we can all come back in a year and talk about what worked and what didn't work in that space and improve from there.
Technology does provide a lot of answers, but it raises a lot of risks as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see how technology advances over the coming year. But for now, Mike O'Donnell from Intel, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Ian. Take care.
As ever, there's plenty more insight and analysis available on the Innovation Forum website, including the usual podcasts and interviews. And look out for a new piece of analysis on the challenges for the agriculture sector over the next 10 years. And don't forget, there's still time to sign up for Innovation Forum's Future of Food event next week and the Ethical Trade and Human Rights Europe conference on 23rd and 24th of June. But that's all for now. I'm Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.